welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
I'm Jeremy Heidi.
And I'm Edmund from Greenville.
Yay! Edmund!
Thank Sometimes you.
Agent 6.
Sometimes. Only when you want no one to know it's really you. I understand that you're not a number, but you are a free man.
Absolutely. Have been for at least a couple of years now.
Nicely done.
And now you have to wonder.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
You have to wonder how many people in this audience are actually old enough or well-versed enough in sci-fi to actually pick up the meaning of that.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've had this. I've been thinking about this in terms of science fiction and rock music and stuff. I'm beginning to feel like I am becoming of an age where the stuff that I grew up on and is influential for me and influential for the current crop of creators, it's really more the compost or the sedimentary strata upon which people are building on. People are beginning to forget, or they're going to look at it and go, oh, that's so quaint. And I'm going to go, get off my Star Trek, you kids. That's kind of how that is, you know?
Yeah, I was very dismayed, extremely dismayed with the news articles that came out about the people on Twitter going, wait, Titanic was something that really happened and not just a movie? I'm like, really? Don't make me hurt you.
Well, they made it happen so they can make the movie.
Okay. No, see, I have to draw a line. If somebody is watching Glory and they go, oh, wait, that really happened, I'm going to hurt someone. It's like, yes, the Civil War really happened. Open a book.
It was greatly exaggerated.
Speaking of things that are not greatly exaggerated, have you guys caught any of the coverage of the Curiosity rover landing from the weekend?
Unfortunately, I have not.
I'm waiting for the cliff notes.
You're waiting for the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet.
No, actually,
I'm the king of Mars.
Actually, yes, I am waiting for the James Cameron Mars special.
Yeah,
he's going to send cameras and stuff and go check it out.
Yeah, right. Well, speaking of cameras, that's what's really cool is Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has the high-rise camera, which is the most advanced, most high-resolution camera that we've sent on a probe to date. And the shots they're taking of the Curiosity landing site are amazing. Get out there and Google them. There's a shot that it caught as Curiosity is descending on the parachute, which is like just 10 times cool. And then they've got a shot of the broader landing area, so you can see where Curiosity's touched down, you can see where the parachute is, you can see where the heat shield has crashed and the sky crane has crashed. I mean, it is just so amazingly cool to see that stuff. And a Google search will find it all for you. I mean, it's just really, you know, I know that in some ways it feels like human exploration is kind of in the doldrums. There's some great, amazing stuff being done in planetary exploration by our robotic pals. And I think we should feel grateful to be alive to witness this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just, I know when I get in all the lead up to this, when they kept describing that landing devices they'd come up with this time, you know, I was just, unfortunately, due to having to get up at a ridiculous hour in the morning, could not stay up to actually, you know, wait for touchdown. But I was extremely happy the next morning to find out that whole sky crane thing actually worked, because I was extremely nervous. You're right. I mean, having those shots from orbit was absolutely wild. You know, after all these years of seeing all those NASA animations of this is what probably happened. It's like, you know,
right.
We're actually seeing.
Yeah.
Are they going to send that thing over to Sirius Planum? Maybe we'll get to see that buried ship.
Well.
Oh wait, this is too early. We shouldn't. We can't know this.
We're going to have a discussion about that here in a little bit, I believe.
Yeah, well, I mean, you do realize that certain probes have failed over the years.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, wait a minute. Which one of the probes failed because they found the Transformers? Was that the one on Mars or the one on the moon?
That's the moon.
Oh, no. Dark Side of the Moon, definitely.
Okay.
That's when we sent Pink Floyd to the moon and they found the Transformers. All right, now that... Oh, God. All right, never mind.
Sorry.
Hey, you kids, get off my toys!
Yeah. Hey, when I had Transformers, they were made out of metal.
When Transformers came up, I was actually legally an adult.
Hey, cool toys are still cool toys.
Well, yeah, let's not talk about my dinky toys of the UFO interceptors and why the heck were they green instead of white.
Anyway. Oh, but even still, Edmund, that's awesome.
And yes, unfortunately, many moves later, they did get misplaced. So.
Oh my! Well, it's obvious that the UFO people have gotten it then.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
But it actually quite amazes me that for what was basically an obscure show, there is still an extremely active Yahoo group and fan base for UFO. So
to completely derail the conversation, I've watched them all recently. I never had the opportunity for many years until recently. And some of it is just really dumb and cheesy, but some of it is just the weirdest psychotronic stuff you've ever seen. It rivals the Prisoner in some of its just weirdness.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, especially those last few episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, the one with the rock that's making everybody hallucinate, and it's great because they're Straker, and they find this rock on the moon that the UFO invaders have left behind, and people who grab it start kind of hallucinating. So Straker has it in his office, and he gets into an argument with his superior, and then this voice goes, "Okay, cut, that's great," and the superior goes, "How was that?" And you pull back, and it's a camera crew.
Yes.
And it's like, and it's this double, the whole thing is like this double layer of realities, because the whole deal was that the UFO project was their cover was that they were a movie studio. And so there's this weird, it's kind of Philip K. Dick in a way. It's like, okay, now wait a minute.
So basically that was probably a very early episode going meta.
No, it was very, very late. It was one of the last ones they did.
Well, I meant on TV in general.
Yeah. It was this. There's this great sense of things being out of joint all of a sudden. Yeah, absolutely. Check it. The second year of UFO really is worth checking out all the way through.
I don't remember a whole lot of UFO. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that one would have like had me just going, "Whoa, what happened there?" And I don't remember that, so I'm gonna have to go find it.
Edmund, you remember the name of the episode? Because I don't.
I'm thinking it might be Time Lash, but unfortunately, with UFO, I am not as up on all the episodes as on Track and B5, but which is silly since there are only about 22 of them. So.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, anyways. All right, guys. Well, now that we've gotten completely off on a tangent, anybody else have anything you want to offer to the open?
Let's see. We got early establishment of a Psycor base on Mars. We got talking about UFO. We got Philip K. Dick. No, that was before the show, but still, it goes in there.
Yeah.
I think we're good. I think we're good.
All right. Well, I think we should talk about some normal, level-headed stuff after
All right,
we come back
then.
From a break.
All right, we'll take a really, really quick break then and come back and talk about The Shadow Within.
Isn't it time that you got away from it all? Now that the Shadow Wars have ended, the planet Zaha-Doom has undergone a huge renovation and has become the playground of the galaxy. We invite you to come see our new massive casinos, our five-star restaurants, luxurious spas, and the finest entertainment in this sector. Come see the masterful technomages Galen and Roy as they dazzle your eyes with the multicolored light spectacular. Come see the original music performances of the Pandorian Blue Man Group, or cross the street and see the original music performances of the Andorian Blue Man Group. And of course, you can still catch Cirque du Soleil. The White Star Cruisers are waiting to take you on the vacation of your dreams. Zadoom. No one leaves the same as they arrive.
And we are way, 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 way back on track.
Yes, we're just talking simple things like ancient alien civilizations.
Yes. And how that ties into tonight's discussion.
The Shadow Within. This is the book number 7, depending upon which printing you're looking at, or it's not the book 7 at all. Gene Cavellos's... How do you just, it's the story of Anna Sheridan and her trip to Alpha Omega 3, Zadoom. And when John Sheridan takes over command of the Agamemnon. So, Edmund.
Yes.
What's your impression on this book?
I liked it. I mean, the funny thing when I was rereading it, because I think I've read it once before, kind of similar to Laura from last week, when she mentioned that she hadn't really heard about the books until she started listening to the podcast, and I was the same way. The moment I heard about them, immediately started hunting them all down. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing with rereading this was I completely remembered all the Anna Sheridan stuff, but kind of forgot about some of the side stuff that was going on. With Delenn and Sinclair and even, John's mission, taking out the home front ship. So it was kind of interesting reading it again and realizing, this isn't just Anna's story. There isn't this other stuff thrown in there too. I'm not quite sure because, I mean, it wasn't that it wasn't memorable, but I guess just, certainly in terms of the background and holes this was filling in, I mean, certainly, her and Morden was the most intriguing part of the story.
Yeah, I found it took me 2 or 3 attempts to get started with this book when I first read it. And then once I got about 4 or 5 chapters in, I thought it really picked up. And I'm with you. It's interesting that knowing, as we do from the series, what happens with Anna, what happens with Morden, the stuff that Cavellos fills in about that story to get them where they are is really, really compelling. The things about the Agamemnon and intercepting the ship that's heading off to bomb Babylon 5, I think Cavellos captures the spirit of this John Sheridan character, there never really seems to be a whole lot of peril with that part of it.
I don't think it's just the fact that, we obviously know that Babylon 5 survives and, obviously Sheridan's going to survive. Because I think, that could still be, I think you can still write suspenseful stuff. But that part of it and the whole whipping the crew into shape and finding the traitors, just doesn't, doesn't quite grab you as much as, I think especially, it was the whole byplay between Anna and Morden. And yes, I do love the fact that, on JMS's instruction, he does not get given a first name.
Yes.
So right. Even now, he's just Morden. And I even found myself this time around, when he first gets introduced, you know, sort of thinking, you know, cause there was sort of little touches she puts in there, you know, where he's like, you know, looking off to the side, you know, and you're thinking, it's like, oh, he's looking at his shadow companion. It's like, oh no, wait a minute. He doesn't have a shadow companion.
Yeah. Yet. Yeah. Yeah. And I felt, I think what was really interesting is how the character of Anna and Morden come together, but it's at that crucial moment when they're in the chamber beneath the surface of when they never call it Zaha Doom in the book, which I think is really cool. You know, it's always referred to as Alpha Omega 3, where Anna picks up the artifact that she knows as a mouse, which is the small shadow artifact that she a kind of artifact that she examines at the beginning of the book, and she's looking at that as a potential way to turn back the imminent shadow attack. And, you know, she knows that maybe she and Morden together can use this thing as a weapon. Well, and of course, when he grabs the first, you know, not only that she now dealing with all those sensations that well up in her when she's touching this thing, you get to the bottom of what Morden's character really is. And it's no wonder that it's not that he turns traitor. It's just that, you know, she realizes that as much as she was trying to help this man deal with whatever tragedy befell him, the loss of his wife and daughter, it was so deep. There really wasn't anything she was ever able to do to help this man. And he was so desperate that he reached out to whatever was offered to help them end their suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just the whole tragedy of that was very nicely encapsulated, and it never felt like it was exposition. You know, it worked in really nicely in a very tense part of the book. It was very, very, I thought it was very well written that way.
Yeah, it was. That element of, you know, just getting this sense, you know, the other, you know, Morden was just sort of set on his path, but also one thing I really noticed this time was sort of that whole ending sequence of when, you know, get with the cave-ins and seeing the chamber with all the crew getting worked on and adapted, and it actually felt to me this time around that, like, I got a real sense of now this is almost like the, you know, a analog to Sheridan going to Zaha Doom, you know, and sort of running down the passageway and seeing all that, except of course in this case, you know, she does not get away the way he was able to.
Right.
Not that he thought he was getting away at the time, but especially, I mean, there's sort of that whole sense of, you know, the shadows closing in around them, and come to think of it, I mean, the fact that, you know, yeah, I mean, they are trying to set a bomb off, just a much smaller one, just to try and take themselves out rather than everything else out. So I mean, there's right. some nice little parallels going on there for what was to come. And obviously, you know, what Anna was going to wind up driving him to do.
Right. Right. And I loved how Covellos writes that final scene when the shadows finally reveal themselves. The line is reality frayed around her.
Yes.
And yeah, that, sure. That really encapsulated, you know, the physicality of her world is collapsing with the cave-ins and people screaming and all the rest, but also, the psychic attacks that are going on.
Yes.
The other thing that I liked in this book is the level of the intrigue that's going on with all the various players behind the scenes. And I think again, Covellos does a really good job of, how do I want to put this? You get a sense of all the things that are going on, but never do you feel as though you're getting an omniscient viewpoint. You always see it through the eyes of Anna Sheridan. And I liked how that gets revealed. And I'm thinking especially of Dr. Chang, who he's the leader of the expedition, the IPX expedition, and he's constantly dropping little hints to Anna not to trust anybody. And Anna would say, "Well, I don't trust this particular person." And Dr. Chang, who is apparently a mentor to Sheridan, to Anna Sheridan, he would say, "Well, you need to widen your field."
Yes.
And to the point where she finds a message that he sent, you know, she stumbles across a message back that he's sending his superiors about the captain of the ship, Hidalgo, is in cahoots with Dunn, who is a Psi Corps member, and they're looking to steal artifacts, and Anna gets upset because she feels betrayed that Chang didn't trust her to tell her this. But, you know, when you read the book and all the ins and the outs of it, it's just as likely that that was Chang's way of trying to get her that information
mm-hmm.
in such a way that it was safer for her.
Yeah. Yeah, although even that was sort of trickily done, because it's, you know, it's... She's trying to send a message out. Hidalgo has actually shut down the communications, presumably because of Chang's message. So, I mean, it's sort of up in the air whether he was trying to warn her, whether it was just this complete happenstance, you know, where, no, she just happened to be trying to send a message right after his, and then, you know, was in checking on it, found that her message and his message were both trapped. You know,
and so her message, of course, is a fairly innocuous message off to John, just to say, "I miss you, I love you, thinking about you," and then she gets frustrated that it doesn't go out, and that's when she finds the bigger piece of it. And then, you know, the other part of it is that Morden is actually a representative of Earth Force, and he was there on Mars at Sirius Planum when the shadow ship was excavated and then taken away by its sister ship. So IPX wants this information, and they and as it's revealed in the book, as Morden tells Anna, IPX wasn't sharing that data.
No,
they probably say would with Earth Force, but their point was, well, we found the ship. This is our information. Earth Force knows. Well, this is something we want to get a hold of. Dunn, who is basically the Psi Corps representative, because of what at the beginning of the book when Anna is investigating what she calls a mouse, which is a small mouse-sized fragment of, as we find out, shadow technology, a telepath actually accidentally sends it off and kills telepaths within, what, like a 3-mile radius or something like that.
Yeah, the 3-mile radius. Yeah, and they were, you know, that was just a P5. So
right, and so Dunn is there, despite, well, you know, yeah, she wants to steal the artifacts, but the other part of it is, you know, she's there to blow up whatever this is, because this is the greatest threat to telepaths. Mm-hmm. So everybody's got all, and then on top of it, she's this weird psycho killer too. You remember the
the trophy roll.
Right. Right. And it doesn't, this I thought was really where Covello shows her skill as a writer. Part of that is to make Dunn seem like there's this whole thing. Anna's got this whole thing, the deductive reasoning detective thing going. If I can just find the one person who's doing this thing, I'll solve the mystery.
Right.
And of course the deal is there's not one person doing this. Everybody's doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it doesn't feel forced. And it kind of throws you for a loop when Dunn shows up, when Morden and Anna are back in the cave where Anna first encountered a shadow creature, and she wants to kill Morden because he blew up a probe that reveals stuff. But her whole point is, I'm not really here to kill you, but I need you. You know, yes, when I'm done with you, I probably will. But that's not my point. I'm not here just to kill people. I'm here for this bigger purpose. Morden's there for a bigger purpose. Anna's the only one there apparently who's wants to just do archaeology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With Dunn, it's like, no, I've got this mission. You know, killing you is just, you know, gravy on the sides.
Right.
It's more of a hobby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, when, that was another thing that in intrigue me the second time around, because I think I did sort of go in order, because I think, the local library, because I was ignoring the other numbered novels. I was just going for the canon stuff. So I got to Shadow Within and City, and then later read the other trilogies, and, you know, of course started, you know, thinking about this stuff, you know, more and more for writing Three-Edged Sword. And my memory of it was, you know, the Psychor killer's along, and she's, you know, there because, you know, as part of, you know, the whole alliance, you know, this is where the alliance with the shadow starts. And then rereading it and going like, oh no, okay, no, she's more on the Bester side of things, you know, trying to eliminate a threat to the telepaths. You know, this isn't about that later, macabre alliance between Clark and the shadows and Psychor. This is more the purist who just wants to make sure that any threats are eliminated.
Right. And it's a frightening threat. I mean, that's one of the things that I really, for me, where the book really gets propulsive is once they land on Zahadum and things start getting going south, you really get a sense of how desperate the situation becomes so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a sense of how alien a world it is, and how Anna's trying to put it all to the pieces all together, and she can never quite grasp it all until it's really too late.
Yeah, because I mean that's just not the way her mind works.
Right.
I mean, if it had been John in that situation, I mean, he probably would have been, you know, figuring out half of it. I mean, that's, you know, I guess to some extent, I mean, that's sort of why they're, you know, I guess that's part of the reason for showing him with the Agamemnon. I mean, and and actually, come to think of it, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, it's John at this time in his career wouldn't have necessarily been picking up on everything. I mean, I think part of that subplot was as much showing Sheridan, you know, evolving from the, you know, gung ho, you know, I'm all for Earth Force type, you know, into, you know, learning a little more of the subtleties of people's motivations and you know, how things aren't always as they seem, and you've got to try and, you know, really, you know, work out where somebody's coming from, and you know, it may not be the person you expect. So it's almost, it's the, you know, this is showing a little bit of the beginnings of him moving from the soldier to eventually the diplomat and the politician years down the road.
Right.
But I was just going to say, I mean, you're right about the whole Zahadum section. I mean, really is driving the end of the book. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, that was what really stuck with me. And then, you know, all that side stuff, you know, it was like, you know, it's like I'd forgotten, you know, Delenn and Sinclair are even in the book until they suddenly pop up. And it's like, oh, okay.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, but that part in particular is just, you know, okay, so it's there for Delenn to try and warn them off, and then it doesn't work.
Yeah, and I guess the reason that that's there, and for people who haven't read the book, what happens is Kosh is actually hanging out around Zahadum and detects that a human ship is coming through an intermediate, tells Delenn, tell the humans to send the ship away. And Delenn, of course, talking with Sinclair, is very cryptic. It's like, do you have a ship heading out to the rim? Sinclair doesn't know anything about it. And Delenn basically says, well, tell them it'd be a very bad idea if they land. Yeah. And won't say anything more. Sinclair trusts that, you know, Delenn would have a reason for doing this. He goes through chain of command, through Earth Force and Earth Dome, and EarthGov, and then, yes, it turns out they do know there's a ship going there, is just a research vessel, and why are the Minbari interested if we're sending a research vessel?
Yeah,
we don't think it's in our best interest to do that, and so, of course, it's too late.
Yeah, so, of course, there's a little jingoistic chest thumping of, you know, we don't let foreign governments determine our where we explore, and if they don't know what's going there, there must be something valuable anyway that we want.
Right. Greedy humans.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting in that I think the point of that was I think as much to give a sense of where in the timeline we are with the Babylon 5 story. There's a certain overlap. Okay, these characters are appearing. This is where they are in the story. So that helps give you a sense of when the main story, the story of Anna Sheridan and Morden and the Icarus, is taking place. So,
yeah,
you know.
Because it is actually Senator Hiroshi, I think, who he talks to at one point. But.
Right, right. So, I mean, that was kind of interesting, but I'm not sure exactly how much that added to the story. I don't know. I just really feel, when I come down to it, I really feel like the stuff about Anna was so strong. The stuff about Morden really enriched that part of the backstory without taking, you know, there was the inevitability of their story that you know is only enhanced by what Kavelis gives you in the novel. That the other stuff just doesn't seem to rise to that level. It's intriguing, it's interesting, but it doesn't have the same emotional resonance, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I know the other thing that was interesting to go back to, what having read the Technomage trilogy now, is, I mean, the other thing she is really good at is getting that sort of, yes, no, I don't know, do you mind if I spoil a slight little thing in the Technomage?
Go for it. Go for it.
Okay. Because, you know, there's a big revelation in there about, you know, Technomage technology being shadow based.
Right.
This is sort of her getting her teeth into this whole thing, you know, having how to describe the way the shadow technology, you know, is so insidious and, you know, and just snakes its way into your system, which I think she does really well here. And then, you know, just, you know, continues developing that throughout the Technomage trilogy.
Right. Right. Well, I thought it was an interesting bit of foreshadowing too, with when Anna Sheridan is piloting the remote probe into the cavern. You know, there's a couple locations that you have. One is the pillar that they find an object called the egg, which is really weird and creepy. And then there's a cave, and so she pilots a remote probe down into it, a little rover, to see what she can see. And all of a sudden, 8 hours have gone by.
And then they mention normally, you know, people can't last six.
Right. But there's that sense of that merging with your tech. The shadows in some way have just taken that to an extreme with their organic technology. But that shows you that humans and are already kind of adapted to that. So they're great to plug into shadow vessels and technology and that sort of stuff. And I thought that was really cool. There's a couple other instances too where Anna's doing something and the way Kavelis lets you know that, wait a minute, more time has gone by than you've realized. You know, we've all experienced those moments in our life where it's like, oh crap, I've been doing this for however long, and I lost track of time. And I think Kavelis does a really good job of getting that sensation across.
Yeah, definitely. But certainly, I mean, that having that whole sequence when she's in with the probe, I mean, was, you know, when you know what's coming, was just a little chilling of, you know, oh no, she really is good at this.
Yeah,
she merges well with machines.
Yes.
So, yeah, right. Actually, that was another odd thing coming back to it, was that whole section at the end of, you know, Anna merged with the machine. I really remembered as being much longer.
It's really only just one page.
Yeah, you know, and then I'm coming to the end, and it's like, you know, wait a minute, it's like, you know, she. She hasn't been merged yet, and it was just such a powerful ending of, you know, yeah, I mean, her, you know, sort of, you know, just, you know, feeling alive and singing along with the machine, and it's almost like, you know, there's another little book in there, a little short story of, Anna's life as a shadow ship before they drag her out. But,
yeah. 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 It's a book well worth reading. You know, I think, and the other part, now let me ask you this one, because here's, spoiler alert, folks. It is described that Morden's wife and daughter are caught in essentially a hyperspace loop.
Right.
That they're just sort of trapped in suspension.
Yeah. Or they might be.
Well, right.
I mean, that was the whole thing. The jump gate being blown up while their ship was in it, and half of the ship winding up in hyperspace, but presumably too damaged to support anybody. But
well, at the end, when Morden finally, not finally, when he just jumps at the chance to end their suffering,
right?
And then he sees a vision of a shadow ship rippling out of hyperspace and destroying the vessel. I came away with this weird sense that that had been machinated by the shadows. You know, that there was that it, through whatever minion, this Morden guy might be the kind of guy that we can use.
Right.
So let's manufacture a situation so that, you know, he'll eventually come here. I don't know. There was just the way that was described. I just got that sense of.
Yeah, I wasn't taking it that far. Although, I mean, I think that's certainly a possibility. I mean, I guess I was thinking of it more in terms of, you know, them more sort of like digging the image out of his head and giving him the closure from it, you know, knowing that would.
Well, that could be too.
Yeah, you know, push him over to their side. You know, giving him what he really wanted.
Right. Yeah, and I did like the bits with the little translations of the inscriptions.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can't remember now. You know what the paraphrase was for the one that was basically what he wants.
Yes. Right. I'm trying to find it here because it was actually really well.
Yeah, because he played with it a couple of times. Yeah, it came with a couple of different versions, I think.
Also, didn't they reference where do we come from? Where are we going? Something like that.
Yes. There was that. Let's see. I'll never be able to find it now that I'm looking for it right here. But yes, it was all that you desire.
That's right. Yeah.
And then and the archaeologists are debating, well, what does that mean? You know, is it, you know, maybe it's an advertisement.
Yes.
Or maybe, you know, but what was really, you know, they bandied about a couple of those things, and then at the end of the little scene there, somebody says something to the effect of, no, maybe it's basically the inscription on the magic lamp that you rub and the genie appears. And right. Anna notes that's what everybody was thinking.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I come away impressed with this part of it, that the way that it's written, the propulsive nature of the narrative, even knowing how it apparently ends up.
Yeah, but still, I mean, it's one of those cases of, I mean, sure, you know how it's going to end, but the way it's filling out the details and you know, the way it's giving you the background, I mean, just, you know, you know, very, very well thought out, very well, you know, it's the characters, I mean, are, you know, because the interesting thing, of course, I mean, even though, you know, Morden was such, you know, a powerful character throughout the show, I mean, you know, he spent his entire time, you know, being the shadow minion. You know, this is the first time you're sort of seeing him, you know, as as a human, even though, I mean, you know, she was foreshadowing in terms of showing, you know, all these little elements of himself, you know, he still retained as, you know, as the shadow representative. You know, they weren't just grafting everything on, you know, no, this was basically taking more than the man and just, you know, giving him a couple of henchmen.
It was very strange for me. Every line I was reading of his, I was just waiting for him to do the bad stuff. It was it was just so weird the whole time.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, I'm like, okay, so there's where the shoe drops.
Right, yeah. Right. And in fact, there's a relationship between Anna and Morden that's a genuine human connection.
Jason in the chat room says that he thinks the shadows lied to Morden the whole time, and they were just stringing him along, using his hope to turn him to their side.
And I think that's a fair interpretation too, and not outside the realm of possibility. You know, as Covellos describes, anytime that the shadows are revealed or reveal themselves. Through Anna's viewpoint, there's always the talk of the hunger and the desire and the chaos and just this overwhelming sense of, I don't want to say evil because that's not quite right, although they kind of characterize it that way, but it's this power that overwhelms rational thought. Here, I found the passage here about the inscription on this object they call the egg.
Yes.
Morn says, my tentative translation is what is desired, though it may say all that is desired. And so they're all thinking about it, and somebody suggests, could it be a manufacturing center? Maybe requesting specifications, perhaps it provided entertainment. And then somebody says, it sounds more like a promise, something you'd find on the side of an oil lamp with a genie inside.
Yeah, and then of course, I mean, when they're actually on the planet, I mean, when they rush back to the egg and Chang's party, you know, then that, and that whole description of, you know, yeah, I mean, how the egg is, you know, or yeah, it's when Dunn catches up with them, she's describing, you know, yeah, how the egg just, you know, is completely calling to them all and just saying, you know, here, come to me.
Right. And it's morphing and grabbing and it's creepy. I mean, it's really the stuff with the shadows. And when they go to the cave that Anna probes had probed with the remote, when she and Morden and a couple other members of the party go actually walking into the cave, they find this sphere and she touches it and she sees this constellation of glowing eyes like Ivanova saw.
Yeah.
And it was that same calling and promising and come to me and give yourself up. And it's creepy. It is just really creepy. So what else, guys? Anything else anybody has to say about this?
There was one other thing I kind of liked that she worked in there. I mean, there's the whole thing that, you know, John goes on about how, and she picks up on at the beginning of the book about, you know, they always say, I love you at the end of every conversation. And, you know, he's like, you know, oh, and they didn't say it the last time. But I kind of liked how, I mean, that in a way they did because, you know, at least through the messages. You know, when you have his messages that he finally, you know, he initially, you know, tries to get in touch with her and they say, oh, no, you can record a message, but we'll monitor it. And he's like, you know, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And then in the end, he does.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the one that she records that, I mean, doesn't get through. But, you know, so that, you know, no, I mean, it's, you know, it's not quite the same thing, you know, but it was just sort of reinforcing that, you know, yes, they didn't get to say it in person.
Well, Kosh intercepted that message, so he could have gave it to Sheridan.
Yeah, but he didn't, and that's why we had to have the brawl in the hall. So.
Maybe he did later when the time was right, you know, when he was leaving.
Yeah.
Jump now. Oh, by the way, you have one new message.
That's what that big blinding light was. You have one message.
It It's just his notification.
I'm still stuck on the brawl in the hall with the, let's get ready to rumble.
All right, guys. Anybody else have anything? All right.
Nope.
I think we've taken this one apart. I think this one gets a good thumbs up from everybody.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I liked it. Yeah. Couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
Quick read too.
Yeah, I went back through it this evening, sort of skim reading it and got caught in. But yeah, like you said, Jeremy, it goes fairly quick. So find it, folks, read it. You'll enjoy it. So what do you say, Summer? Take a break, come back, do a close?
Sure. Let's take us out, Jeremy, and we'll come right back with a little wrap-up and outline the rest of the plans for the next couple of weeks.
My name is Austin Crowley, and this is the world's only pawn shop specializing exclusively in the occult. Whatever you're selling,
give me 40 bucks for it.
75.
60 if you make out for 2 minutes.
If it was ripped screaming from the chest of a virgin cheerleader, we'll make you a hell of a deal.
Pawnofthedead.com.
And we are through, I guess you'd call it the tougher reads of the series. Is that fair?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it all gets better from here on in. Well, I don't know. I have issues with the Centauri trilogy, but we'll get to that when the time comes.
Alrighty then.
Hey, speaking of, since we're on the theme of prequel, if you will, or the story before the story, I've had a chance to read the first handful of issues that are out for Before Watchmen. And I have to say, all you people out there are really upset about it, swallow your fanboy pride and pick them up.
Okay.
Really?
Especially the Silk Spectre one. Yes. Yeah. Darwin Cook's writing and illustrating the Minutemen one, which is good because in proper fashion, I've only got the first issues of those, and I haven't seen the Dr. Manhattan one yet. It gives you the art is great. In all of them. I mean, it's well worth checking out for that. But the Minutemen one is really good. Silk Spectre starts off with Laurie as a teenager, sort of an outsider at school and dealing with her mom, who is training her to be a superhero. But I had glommed, okay, spoiler alert, whether this is what they want or not, but it really, you get a sense from reading it now that part of what she's doing is toughening up her little girl so she doesn't get raped like she did.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, and it's just, and I'm impressed. I got to tell you, I mean, I didn't have the same level of ire as some of the internet people had. But really, if you're standing on principle to not read these things, step off your principle and check them out.
Yeah, no, I wasn't standing on principle. I mean, I think, you know, Alan Moore doesn't have too many legs to stand on. I mean, especially once I heard that, you know, yeah, I mean, it's not like DC wasn't trying to interest him in it and he
right.
was just refusing. It's like, you know, no, it's not, you know, they were willing to throw money at him if he wanted to accept it.
Yeah, well, and I understand it's not about the money for him. It's about storytelling part of it.
Absolutely. But the big thing for me is just, I mean, I'm so many years and decades removed from, you know, buying comics regularly that, you know, no, I've actually didn't even realize until a couple of weeks ago that they'd actually started it up. So,
Yeah.
But on your recommendation, I mean, since I do have the original ones sitting over there in their plastic sleeves, you know, I think it would make sense to pick them up. So, and not just wait for the trade paperback.
Yep. So. Summer, you got anything?
No. I was just reminiscing about an argument we started having on Slice of Sci-Fi about Days of Future Past, since that was the newly revealed title of the next X-Men First Class movie. And we got into an argument in the comments, or a lengthy and involved, passionate discussion.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and actually, I just realized there's something I would like to mention, which I was going to hold off until we got to Psycor Trilogy, but I just realized timing-wise, probably should be mentioned now, that, of course, our beloved Agent Bester, Walter Koenig, is getting his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in early September, and Planet Expo has actually now turned that whole weekend into like this sort of mini convention for Walter. Which,
wow.
Good.
Oh, yeah. No, you know, there's, I think the actual ceremony's on Monday, but they're doing like panels on Sunday and screenings at the Egyptian Theater of, you know, favorite episodes and Inalienable, I think, you know, one of his movies. And, you know, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, unfortunately, I will not be able to make it out to Los Angeles, but anybody who does, it looks like they're going to have one very entertaining time.
Cool. Well, we're happy for Walt, definitely.
Yep, definitely. And I also, Neil had posted into the chat room back when we started that Lee Whiteside started up a 20th anniversary thread for B5.
Oh, cool.
20th anniversary.
Makes you feel old, doesn't it?
Not that old.
94. I think he's plotting something.
Yeah.
Because he started plotting a Discworld thing a couple of years before it actually came to pass here. So well,
Jason says the gathering started shooted 20 years ago, Friday.
Oh my God.
So
yep.
Wow. Okay. So he's going from the day they literally dropped the flag on filming. Wow. So it has been 20 years.
20 yeah, years.
Because the pilot aired in what, 93?
93,
no,
yeah.
Was it 93?
Yes,
yeah,
it was.
Because the year premiered in 94.
Yeah, because it was almost a year, which is, you know, not that I want to go down the whole DS9 rabbit hole, but... You know, that's why everybody, you know, they all go into, you know, oh, but DS9 started first. It's like, no, it didn't. Anyway.
Yes, and Jason has supplied the information. February 22nd, 1993 is when the gathering aired. So, yeah, we've got less than 6 months to go before 20 years. Holy crap. Okay, who else feels old?
Yeah, well, even more amazing, when you started the podcast, did you imagine you'd still be doing it?
Yeah, that's true.
20th anniversary was rolling around.
Wow.
Crap. I've been doing this a long time.
Wow. So let's see. The show...
It's all your fault, Edmund.
Is it Edmund's fault?
Well, this week it is.
Okay. Because let's see, the show...
It was Gary's fault last week.
Okay.
It's always the guest's fault.
So we have been doing...
Well, why do you think we're having you on? We need a scapegoat.
We have been doing the podcast for one-third, more than one-third as long as the show has existed.
Yeah.
Oh my
well,
goodness.
To be fair, Babylon 5 really never took time out to give you a whole episode about Snack Man.
True.
Are we sure? Because the bacon and eggs episode, come on.
Well, yeah. Well, that's a subplot. That's not the whole thing.
Okay. That's so, but it's a B story. Come on.
Yeah. That's true. Anyway.
It's good to be a fan geek, right?
Yeah, and now I've got images of them, you know, swapping their diets and thinking, like, wait a minute, did Snackman prepare one of those plates?
Right, yeah.
And then you've got Garibaldi sneaking in the ingredients to make his anniversary dinner, his honorary. Right. Yeah. All right. Who's hungry?
Yeah, me now.
Yeah, when you're hungry, you're hungry.
When you're hungry.
When you're hungry, you're hungry.
All right.
I think we've covered everything, right?
Yes, we have.
All right. Next week will be Feedbackapalooza, so make sure that if you've had any questions or comments or corrections, because sometimes we do miss things, not often, but sometimes, go ahead and call them in now to the voicemail line, and we will go as long as we need to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making that call now. If we have a lot of voicemails, we will go as long as we need to. If we have to break it into two shows to post them, that's fine. But we're going to get through as many as Tim can collect for Jeremy next Wednesday. As always, the website is BabylonPodcast.com. The email address is BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. The phone number is, what's the phone number? 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year we found out what we wanted.
And if you can, go to the website and donate. We are hosting this ourselves these days, so I have to pay for hosting. So every little bit helps. Every little bit does help. Literally, it doesn't go to the magic beer fridge for the Slice of Sci-Fi guys. This actually goes to me to help pay to keep this online. So if you can donate a dollar. Every bit of it goes to the support of keeping the website online and actually keeping me online. So, thank you for your support. Thank you for listening to us for all these years. And even though we're winding this up, everything will stay on there. We may actually do at this point. I'm not adverse to doing a 20th anniversary show next February.
Yeah, right.
So you never know. Something else might pop up in the feed or on the website. So thank you all. Thank you, Edmund. And we'll see you all next time on the other side of the gate.